Who Gets to Decide? A liberty-based podcast that brings a little piece of sanity to a confused society drowning in a culture of craziness. And here is your host, Seth Martin.
All right. What's up, everybody? And welcome to another episode of Who Gets to Decide. This is episode 424, and I am Seth Martin, your host. Thank you for joining me this evening. Glad you're here and happy you're listening. For those of you joining for the first time, this show is all about you, your liberty, about the state and its totalitarian ways, and we're just bringing you various stories that demonstrate that with a little bit of explanation from yours truly. Well, today, I want to circle back to the financial markets because we're at another precarious place. Now, before I continue too much, we could make a new high in the market, okay? That's certainly possible. But the market is getting narrower and narrower. And what does that mean? That means that fewer and fewer stocks are performing well. And there's something called internals, market internals, like the advanced decline line and the up-down volume numbers. They have been really, really bad for weeks now. And it's possible, in fact, it's probable that the market is trying to top. But again, that doesn't mean that it can't make a new high. It just means that we need to be on guard. And for those of you that are long-term investors and have your money in 401ks and things like that, you should spend a little time, I think, thinking about what you're going to do if the market really rolls over and starts to accelerate to the downside. So in the spirit of that, there's a YouTube video that I've clipped out some recordings from Jeremy Grantham. Jeremy Grantham is one of the most successful hedge fund and portfolio managers that's ever walked the earth. He's probably in his mid-70s today. And he still does this for a living and is very, very successful. Jeremy Grantham, these really good guys like Jeremy Grantham and Jim Rogers and even Peter Schiff, even though Peter Schiff has been bearish for a really long time, Peter Schiff is very good at what he does. And he's trying to bring more attention to the self-inflicted nature of these market tops and collapses. It is very self-inflicted. These are distortions in the market that lead to these really dramatic depression type situations. And if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense, right? So if you go out and you borrow money, okay, which is what the Fed does, the Treasury will go out and borrow money. And when they borrow that money, that brings a whole bunch of new money into existence, which tends to have kind of an artificial lifting phenomenon to the market. But this causes lots of distortion. So if you just think about yourself, if you borrow money, let's say you borrow money to buy a car, okay? And let's say you borrow $50,000, you buy a really nice car. Well, what that means is while you're paying for that car, whatever money you were spending every month has to go down. Like you let's say it's an $800 a month car payment. That means that you have $800 less every month to spend on things you were spending before. And when you do this over and over and over again, eventually what happens is you consume all your ability to earn money in the future at the expense of paying for something today. And this eventually catches up, obviously, to everyone that takes on debt, but it also catches up to governments, and it creates distortions. It creates an artificial kind of a boom in the market because new money comes into the market, new credit comes into the market, and that money goes into things. It goes into housing. It goes into stocks. It goes into bonds. It goes into all kinds of different assets. And assets are just anything that you can own. And that's essentially what an asset is. And what Jeremy Grantham is going to talk about today, he's mostly talking about the features of these dislocations. And loosely, he calls them bubbles. And this is obviously a term everybody knows now, and it's not new. But a bubble is essentially a distortion in the market. And it can be a monetary type bubble. It can be a regulatory type bubble. These bubbles take different forms. But in our financial system, largely, they're financial type bubbles. They're monetary policy, borrowing, spending, things like that that cause these dislocations. And essentially, you have more and more resources being directed by the government, or the government's borrowing and spending, than is actually being directed by the market. People like you and me making decisions about what we want to buy and how much we want to buy and things like that. So this creates a distortion, which again, Jeremy Grantham calls, broadly speaking, bubbles. So I want to play some clips from Jeremy. This is probably going to be a little bit longer episode just because, man, I just could not narrow down the clips far enough. I just thought the ones I saved were very important. And there's still a whole lot more to go listen to. So I want to encourage you to go to the show notes page and click on the link and listen to the YouTube video, or watch it, from Jeremy Grantham, and listen to, try to follow what he's talking about. Today, I'm gonna interpret a lot of what he's talking about so that the audience is able to keep up with what's going on in his talk. But go back and listen to it a couple of times. He's talking about something that's only happened maybe, it's only happened, including the Great Depression, or including the 1929 crash, it's only happened four times in the last 100 years. And that's you're talking about very rare situations. So go back and listen to Jeremy's full discussion, and multiple times if you need to, and try to get a handle on this. Because one of the things he challenges you to do is to gather a battle plan. Because once one of these situations kind of gets ahead of steam, your decision-making process becomes very difficult. Most people can't cope with making decisions in the face of, you know, pure panic. There's a fundamental, almost a prehistoric part of your brain that takes over that causes, you know, what they call the herding mentality. It causes you to herd and follow the crowd, and a lot of times the crowd's not doing the right thing. So anyway, just wanted to point that out. But I will be chiming in here periodically to discuss the various topics that Jeremy's talking about.
That's a pretty good indicator of impending trouble when people's confidence in the following year is so lousy, and it's unusual, and it has seldom been this bad. History will say that the 21st century is unusual, abnormal, aberrant even. The window from 2000 until now has been abnormally high profit margins, abnormally high PEs, abnormally low interest rates, etc. 40 years of lower and lower interest rates push asset prices up, particularly housing, through the mortgage mechanism. How can it not? If you can afford to pay more for your house because the mortgage rates are 3%, sooner or later you pay more for it.
Okay, so very quickly here, there's a couple things going on when interest rates are falling. Now, interest rates fluctuate all the time based on the cost of capital or how much savings there is in the economy. If the savings rate is high, interest rates tend to go down, and they tend to, when they go down, they tend to incentivize borrowing and disincentivize savings. But when interest rates go up, savings goes up and borrowing goes down. The problem with a central bank is the central bank can drive interest rates below what the market needs. So just think about all the people that you think of that have savings. And I'm not talking about savings in 401ks necessarily. I'm just talking about savings to loan. There's actually been very little of that in the 2000s, and yet interest rates have been driven to their lowest point really in history. And this creates, this directs capital in the economy in a way that is not sustainable. Just think of it look at the EV example, okay? When you have all this money, people build, you know, gigafactories and Tesla factories and things like that. And then people get tax credits for buying Teslas and so on and so forth. And what happens is the government in the investment in a particular area is directed into EVs. But what are we seeing now with EVs? We're seeing that EVs are, Ford and Chevy and the big three automakers are pulling back from the EV business. Why? Because, well, they can't figure out how to make money at it. This was an unsustainable boom. The government directed resources in this EV market. All these companies invested and spent money and retooled. And now they're having to back away from it at a huge loss, by the way, because the effort is not sustainable. Why is it not sustainable? Because the market didn't want that quantity of EVs in the first place. And so this is just one example. And there are hundreds of examples you could find in the marketplace that are following this same pattern. Well, eventually this causes huge problems in the market, and it will ripple into stocks and different financial instruments.
Are we in a major bubble?
Yeah, of course. If you look at a 10-year smoothed average PE and a Shiller PE, you find that there's a pretty decent spike in 1929, a much higher spike than that in 2000, and a slightly lower spike than that now. This is approximately the second highest point, higher than 29. And in each case, they back and fill, and they go back to more average levels. Even if you allow for a moderate increase in the normal Shiller, we know the market doesn't like inflation. Let's find other things that the market likes or doesn't like. And let's explain, on a coincident basis, why the market sells high and low. It turns out the market is a coincident indicator of comfort. What makes the typical portfolio manager feel comfortable? And number one, it loves low inflation. Yeah. It hates high inflation. It likes 2% stable inflation. It does not like to see it bouncing around. It doesn't like to see it spike in the worst way. And it does not like to see it hanging around for multiple years. That's the most important one. Secondly, it loves high profit margins. What a surprise. Now, way, way down in third place is the stability of growth. The growth rate does not have a positive correlation with PE. The market is nervous about bursts of high growth. It doesn't like +9, -2. GDP it would rather growth. Have +3, +3, +3 than +9, -2, even though it averages high. Certainty. It likes certainty, stability. Yeah. Comfort is the best description.
Another description, rather than comfort, is mood, okay? And I want you to substitute, he's talking about portfolio managers, what makes them comfortable. I want you to substitute portfolio manager with people, consumers, people walking around, buying things, you know, living out their lives in the economy. When those people get uncomfortable or their mood begins to shift, then you can start to have some of these problems that he's talking about. And these are very unusual times. Okay. He's going to talk later in his talk that there's only been, I think he says four great bubbles, but maybe there's three and he's looking at the fourth one coming. So you're talking about very, very rare events, but what is he talking about? What makes people uneasy? What makes them uncomfortable? What puts them in a mood that is socially, let's say, discontent? Well, these things like inflation or it could be opportunity and things like that. And this kind of changes people's outlook. And this is why he mentioned that when people are looking at the upcoming year versus the current year, when that mood shifts downward, this is a very tricky place for financial instruments. And generally, leads to an overall decline. Now, the decline could happen. It could happen rapidly. That's possible. It could happen rapidly and then come up and then go back down, and it could just oscillate around for decades even. But the market has a tendency to get to cause people, the most amount of people, to lose the most amount of money. That's what the market tends to do. I like to equate it to like a raft. Let's say you're on a raft with a bunch of people. And I don't know, let's say there's a dolphin on one side of the raft, and everybody in the raft jumps over to the other side of the raft to look at the dolphin. Well, what's going to happen to the raft? It's going to flip over. And that's kind of what happens in the market, is once everybody is all on one side of the trade, everybody's bullish, nobody's bearish, then what happens is the market tends to flip over. And this can be very, very dramatic. I mean, so dramatic that you may or may not have time to react to it. And this is part of what Jeremy Grantham is warning about.
So you look at this model, and it says 1929 should not have been a surprise. It had low inflation, high profit margins, wonderful profit margins, incidentally. And the growth rate was ticking along at a pretty high rate, and it was stable. So heaven. The market called the Great Depression. Everything was bad. It got the Nifty 50 right on the nose. It got the idea in the 70s that you'd be seven times earnings because terrible inflation, persistent terrible inflation, low margins, wild economic growth. Yeah. So it 6.8 times earnings was the trough, and the model called for almost exactly that. So then it makes what you might call a major error for the first time in 2000. It says in 2000, wonderful profit margins, no inflation. You'll have the highest PE that you have ever seen. Not bad, directionally. Instead of 21 times in 1929, a new peak of 25 times. And it goes to 35 times. And that was not explained by anything we could see in history or then. It just happened. You could argue that that is the only really crazy psychological event up until then in American history.
He's making reference to a model, and we don't exactly know what the model is, but whatever the model is that he uses, he said, you know, predicts this type of behavior that happened in 1929. It happened again in the 70s during the Nifty 50, but it was a little bit off during 2000. And the model, the response to the model, I guess, maybe is more accurate way to say it, changed a little bit. And he's saying, look, when profit margins are really high, PE ratios are really high, everybody's making a lot of money, stocks are going up, this is when you should really be on guard, because this is when things tend to have gone too far and there's some sort of correction. Now, he's going to start talking about, you know, deviations. The deviations he's really talking about have to do with the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve, he didn't expressly say it in this previous one, but he's talking about how the Fed drove interest rates really, really low after the 2000, the internet bubble. And the other thing that's interesting about 2000, I want to go ahead and point out, is if you divide the market by gold, the price of gold at the time, 2000 was what a lot of people call peak prosperity. The market was worth about 40 ounces of gold. And today it's worth, you know, something less than 20. So even though the market's much higher today, in terms of real money, it's actually lower. It's actually about 50% of what it was in 2000. And this is part of why you're experiencing a more difficult time, higher, you know, your standard of living is going down, because even though stock prices are, you know, higher than they've ever been, in terms of real money, they're actually down and about by 50%. And this is causing a lot of problems in the market. People are really struggling. There's always been people struggling in the U.S. economy, right? The bottom 30% or 25% or something has always struggled in America. That's just the way it is. But now you've got that line is moving closer to 50%, 60%, 70%. You got like 70% of Americans struggling now. And that's something different. That's very different than what has happened in the past.
And then it brings us to the second major deviation. Second major deviation starts in the second half of 21. Second half of 21, we have an inflation spike. Every time we've had an inflation spike in history, PEs have gone down, sometimes rapidly. This one was a strong inflation spike. Bloody PEs went up, creating a major gap where the model goes down and the market goes up. And suddenly we've got a big gap. Then the market says, after all, I'm not sure I believe the Fed. And the beginning of 22 is the worst 6 months since 1939. But the model is still going down because inflation is hanging around and the model declines. So fast forward, what does it say today? It doesn't like the pattern of stickiness in the inflation. It doesn't like the profit margins, which in real terms have been coming down quite steadily now for over a year. They're down over 15% adjusted for inflation. And the model calls for 16.8, which in the long term is still pretty high. But the actual market is 29.
Times earnings.
Yes, on a Shiller, smooth basis. And on a Shiller, it's 29. This is a pretty handsome gap. And what this says is, that is if the market responds to the same forces that it responded to over an entire 100-year period. It's only been different for a couple of years since inflation spiked.
Okay, so I guess what he's saying in this model is when you have an inflation spike, PE should go down, but PEs have gone up, even though profit margins have gone down. And obviously, this is some sort of dislocation in the market. And it likely has to do with the Fed and the amount of money they printed and different types of assets they bought during COVID. Now, I think it's important really here to define the word inflation, because a lot of people think inflation is just prices going up over time. And that's really more of a result of inflation, okay? Actual inflation, the definition of inflation is the growth of money and credit in the economy. And the growth of money and credit is a monetary issue, okay? So that's a Federal Reserve issue. Now, what causes price inflation is that the Federal Reserve creates more money and credit than goods are produced. In other words, if we start to produce more money, we start to put more money and credit into the economy than we are actually producing in goods to offset that money, then you get price inflation. But I think it's really important to point out here that there's always inflation. The Fed is always borrowing money into existence, and the banks are creating money. And when the banks loan money, it creates money into existence. So the money supply is always growing. There's always inflation, monetary inflation. It's just that when the economy slows down, or let's say goods produced slows down, well, we start to see a rise in prices. And that's what we're experiencing. And like he's saying, it's persisting. And it's created this gap in PEs between 29 and 16.8, which is a sizable gap. Another way to think about this gap is you could call it a dislocation. You could say it's some sort of misalignment in the market. And at some point, everybody will recognize it, and there will be a huge correction to realign those disparate figures. If one of them is 29, in other words, if actual prices of stocks is at 29 PE ratios, but the actual profit margins that companies are producing 16.8, then there's obviously either profit margins are going to have to go way up, or prices are going to have to come way down. And that's what he's alluding to.
Now, 1929, 2000, 1974, the Nifty 50, every one of these, we were going to have a soft landing. Trust me, check the data. Everything was going to work out fine. It never does. So in 1929, the S&P was kind enough to have a low-priced index, which was pure junk. Pure junk had been up 80% plus in 1928, and it's dropping all the way through 1929. The day before the crash, it's down almost 40% before the crash. It is the great, I like to say, primal scream from the stock market ever up until then. Nothing like that happens again until 1972. In 1972, the S&P is up 17. The average big board stock is down 17. That's not bad. Then nothing like that happens again until 2000. In 2000, we know what happened. They take out the growth stocks and they go down basically 50% before rallying. And the rest of the S&P goes up.
Yeah.
So in September, the S&P is the same as it was at the peak in March of 2000.
Right.
In the meantime, the growth stocks have gone down 50%.
NASDAQ has gone down huge.
So the rest of the S&P, ex the super growth stocks, has gone up about, we calculate, 13, 14, 15%. Same thing has happened. High beta stocks have gone down. Blue chips continue up. And it happened this time too, only the fourth time in history where, going back to 2021, starting with QuantumScape and quickly going through Kathy Wood's portfolio and on through the meme stocks and everything, there is an ugly year following my waiting for the last dance.
Because
lasted right through the end of December. But that is exactly what it did in the other three bubbles. In other words, if you're predicting a bubble, you should be saying, and the characteristic of this decline will be this unique, odd event where the super leaders with the highest betas go down as the last gasp of the blue chips. And okay. Then the bubble will break.
What he's talking about here is what I was describing in the very beginning of the show, is that you have a narrowing of the market. Okay, so think of like companies like IBM and Walmart, and you know, the big companies are going down. But you got your NVIDIAs and SMCI and Palo Alto Networks and these, what they call the Magnificent Seven, were driving into new highs. So this is exactly the phenomenon he's describing. And he said this happens every time at a bubble. You get the blue chip, you know, the Procter & Gamble's, the Walmart's, the big company, the Microsoft's, big companies that are kind of always, you know, omnipresent in the market, are going down, 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 down. They're in decline, and there's a handful of stocks that are pushing things higher. And that is exactly what has been happening. And the reason, one of the big reasons I'm doing this program today about this subject, is because that appears to have stopped or is dramatically slowing. Okay, let me say it that way. So, it could be that NVIDIA is done going up. Palo Alto Networks is done going up. You know, the leaders, okay? The big leaders in that. Meta is done going up. But if you go back and you look at some of the blue chip companies, they've been going down for months. In fact, it all started more than a year ago. And some of them are just kind of trading sideways now. But really what he's saying is that all you need is you need these leaders, these Magnificent Seven that led us into recent all-time highs, to roll over and start going down. And you've got potentially a bubble bursting on your hands. And the question is, you know, what are you going to do? What are you going to do if that begins to happen? Because a battle plan is very, very important to have, because like I said, in the heat of the moment, you're just frozen. You don't know what to do. You're not sure how to handle it. And so you need to kind of decide ahead of time about what you're going to do. If you make a mistake, you can always, you know, change. But what you can't recover from is like what happened in 1929. The market went down 89% from high to low. I mean, 89% loss in your 401k is, you know, you just are not going to recover from that. So, The other thing about that I want to say just real quick is that if you go back and you look at a 100-year chart on like a log scale chart, what you'll see is the trend started in 1932 at the end of the 1929 crash. And that trend has been intact for a very long time. And even if we just get a pullback in that trend, it could be substantial. It could go all the way back to the 2009 lows. And again, that would be a substantial loss to your net worth, to your portfolio value. So you just need to kind of be thinking about that.
Bubbles, it's not just about price. If you get price and it's boring, that is not a peak. Higher prices plus crazy behavior, which is unique, that you have never seen anything quite that.
And NFTs qualify?
Absolutely. Yes. Meme stocks qualify.
Sure, absolutely.
QuantumScape is the biggest scale of any bubble in history. There was nothing that scale.
Visual
any
company.
Individual stock.
Yeah.
Japan, yeah. Real estate is the mother and father of all bubbles, much bigger than their stock market, which is the mother and father of all stock bubbles. Their real estate was over 10 times downtown Manhattan. And downtown Manhattan was very high priced. Downtown Tokyo was over 10 times. That's the biggest bubble, I think, in history, including the South Sea bubble. Stock market in Japan went to 65 times stated earnings. There was some cross-ownership complexity, but it looked like an amazing, amazing bubble. I think everybody else is guilty of the usual crime of expecting a soft landing when it never comes, but is always claimed, believing the Fed, who has never gotten one of these bubbles right, regardless of the fact they have involved several different Feds, underestimating the time that it takes for some of these things to work through, particularly real estate. And I'm sympathetic on that one because real estate is a global bubble. It has driven house prices provably to multiples of family income all over the world. China, you know, Beijing, Shanghai, you tell me, 15 times, 20 times family income, Sydney, Adelaide, etc. Canada, the UK, London, they used to be multiples of 3.5 times family income. London is now 10, Toronto's worse, etc., etc. No one can afford to buy a house. In the 70s, 80s, 90s, we always stated everything inflation adjusted. Nobody is stating anything inflation adjusted now. Anything.
Yeah, I think this point here is really important. It's not just about price. It's about a mania. It's about price with like crazy stuff going on. Okay, so you, for example, all this AI stuff, you got even Wendy's coming out saying in their earnings announcement that, you know, they're going to be looking into AI in their company. Well, how would Wendy's be using AI? You know, they're talking about using it in the drive-thru. And of course, companies at the center of this AI stuff were, you know, NVIDIA and what's the other company's name? SMCI, which stands for Supermicrocomputer. And these stocks just went crazy. Like SMCI, Supermicro, went from $226 a share to $1,229 a share from like October of last year to, you know, April 1st or March 1st or something like that. That's a 440% increase. I mean, it's insane. NVIDIA went from 392 to 974, which is like 150% increase. And NVIDIA is a huge company. Okay. So it's not like these are penny stocks that have just gone crazy. These are big companies and people betting on the future of AI. And, you know, AI is going to be a big deal one day, but it's kind of like the internet in 2000. The internet in 2000, I mean, people were changing their company name to .com, you know, and what happened is ultimately the internet did fuel a big boom in the market, but it wasn't until, you know, it didn't really start until like 2005, 2006. So a lot of times these things are much further away than we think. I mean, I always like to say, you know, if AI is going to be this big revolution, then it's going to replace all these jobs and it's going to do all this stuff, then why am I sitting at a stoplight with four other people in the intersection, all stopped, looking at traffic lights? Why can't we, you know, make the intersection know that, you know, there's one person, or maybe I'll be sitting there at a stoplight and all the other intersections, there's no cars there. But I'm the only one stopped, and it could easily turn my side green and keep the other side stopped since there's no cars there, but it doesn't. And this is kind of the conundrum, you know, a lot of this gets, it's a mania. And speaking of manias, one of the most famous manias, I don't know if you've heard about this, but there's a mania called the Tulip Mania. And this happened in Europe and specifically in the Netherlands. And this was during, you know, when the Dutch were exploring the world, like in the 1630s. And essentially what happened was people were buying homes. Tulips became very popular. And people were buying homes and they were loaning money based on tulips. And the price of tulips went sky high. I mean, and of course it ended in just a massive collapse in the price of tulips. But tulips got very expensive. People were taking them as collateral on homes and all kinds of crazy things. I mean, today we would go, what? Tulips? You know, the tulip bulb. Yeah, but go read about it in Wikipedia. It's very, very bizarre. But these manias do take hold. You know, people kind of lose their mind about what's valuable and they speculate. And things just kind of go crazy. And this is what Jeremy Grantham's talking about. It's not just price. It's price plus a mania plus, you know, psychotic price action and silly things like non-fungible tokens, you know, which is, it's like a digital record of, you know, a digital painting or something. It's like a, it's not even a real painting. It's just an image, you know. It could be like a baseball card or something like that. So there's all kinds of crazy stuff like that going on. He mentions the meme stocks. And you know, you just got a lot of this going on, and this causes people to really fear they're about missing out, and they just start plowing money into stuff because what they see is it going up, and they don't, even though they can't explain it, they're like, I've got to put money in it. You know, that's the way they rationalize it.
Every category, rich, medium, poor, feel nervous and less well off than they were last year, regardless of the data. And some of the issues that came up were the ending of some of the stimulus programs, like no payment of student debt, just ending one after another. That's a pretty good indicator of impending trouble when people's confidence in the following year is so lousy, and it's unusual. Secondly, do you know what the record of the leading indicators is? It's dynamite. The leading indicator is a wonderful indicator, and it has seldom been this bad. But the great bubbles, and they're the only ones I'm interested in, the four great bubbles, they can take a long time. The bear market in 2000 was a three-year bear market, and that was a gentle recession. No problems. The housing market was cheap. The bond market was cheap. It was as specific and localized as you could get. And we had a three-year bear market, 72% decline in NASDAQ. Amazon went down 92% before rallying like mad. This was pretty painful. You make a mistake, you have a Great Depression. You make a mistake, you have a recovery like the 70s. Since Greenspan, the Federal Reserve has got nothing important right, right? Every time it turns, it gets it wrong. Every opinion it gives about a soft landing is wrong. And their battle plan has been wrong. Their battle plan was push up the market to help the economy. And they pushed up the market, and they pushed it three different times, and it did help the economy. The trouble is, they always went down. So they have it rise through the 90s and collapse in the early 2000s. Then they have it rise to the housing bubble and collapse with the housing bubble. And the financial world is brought to the edge of destruction. It really was on its knees. And then they push it up, and here we are once again. Same high prices, about the same as 2000, and far higher than anything else.
So I want to dig into this term that he uses a little bit, where he says they push it up. He's talking about the Fed. He's talking about the Federal Reserve. What are they pushing up? What are they doing? Well, they're buying assets. They could be buying treasuries from the United States Treasury. They could be buying mortgage-backed securities, which is or bonds that trade on home loans. There's all kinds of assets that the Fed buys, and when it does this, it creates money. Why does it create money? How does that happen exactly? Well, the Fed doesn't have any money. So when it buys something, it has to create money in order to buy it. And this is literally how money is created. Now, there's a secondary effect that creates money, and that's when banks loan money. So when you go, let's say you go buy a $100,000 house, but you don't have $100,000. So you go to the bank and you sign some papers, and the bank gives you $100,000. Well, that $100,000 comes from nowhere, okay? They say it comes from demand deposits and other bankers' accounts, other bank holders, account holders' accounts. But the reality is only about 10% of it, or really less than that, 5% of it comes from other account holders. 95% of it is created just by loaning the money. And then, of course, what happens over a 30-year period, you end up paying the bank back $300,000. So they got their $100,000 back plus an additional $200,000. And this is how money is created in the economy. And the problem is it constantly erodes your standard of living. Now, my friend Jim, he likes to always say, well, Seth, I just don't want to talk about this because there's nothing I can do about it. And one of the reasons I'm harping on this show all the time about honest money is, yeah, okay, maybe you individually cannot do anything about it. I individually cannot do anything about it. But what we can do is make sure people know about this. Make sure they understand why every year that goes by, their life seems to be getting harder and harder. This is not just because of greedy capitalists. Okay, that's not why that happens. The reason it happens is because of greedy politicians that want to spend money and want to enrich themselves and their friends at our expense. This is why it happens. And the mechanism by which all that happens is the Federal Reserve, our central bank. Now, one of the things that Jeremy Grantham did not talk about here, and I think it's very important, is every central bank around the country, or excuse me, around the world, did the exact same thing our central bank did. So later on in the talk, and I don't record it, but he talks about how, you know, European stocks are the best priced right now. Like if he was going to put money somewhere, he's going to put it in European stocks. But I can promise you that when we have this correction, this sell off, it's going to hit everybody. Japan, everybody in the industrial world, in the advanced world. It's not going to hurt people in Africa. Their lives aren't going to change much at all. They're going to suck as bad then as they do now. But people that live in the fiat money world, it's going to be tough everywhere, and there's not going to be a place to hide. And so the question is, you know, what is it? What becomes more valuable during that time? And I can just tell you 100% cash. Cash is valuable when you have a worldwide deflationary event. That's what's valuable is cash. And of course, gold and silver and things like that, things that are real money. But this is why I harp on real money so much here, is because these criminals are stealing from us. And most people don't understand how it happens. They just feel like they'll say to themselves, man, every year gets harder. I just don't see how I can, where it's going to come from. I don't see how I can make my life work. You know, these are the types of conversations your average people are having. But look, average people need to learn about the Federal Reserve and what it's doing to all of us, because otherwise we're never going to get rid of it. It's a political animal. It can only be gotten rid of politically. And if people don't know about it, if people think, hey, look, the problem is the Democrats, and the Democrats think, hey, the problem is the Republicans, you see how we never get to the root cause? We never get to the Federal Reserve. And this is why it's so important for us all to understand what is happening when it comes to the monetary system. And I know it's not sexy. I know it's not interesting. I know it's boring, and most people don't want to talk about it, just like my friend Jim. His eyes glaze over. But there's got to be, we've got to understand that this is the path. Unless we're going to go back on the gold standard, which would necessarily get rid of the Federal Reserve, you know, there is no way to improve our lives. There's no way to stop what is happening. And look, I mean, I almost consider it to be my mission is to spread the news about the Federal Reserve and what it's doing to each and every one of us. And I don't care if you're rich, I don't care if you're poor, I don't care if you're middle class, this mechanism is hurting you. And so with that, I want to wrap up the show. I want to thank you for coming in. Come back and listen. You know, I'm trying to find some interesting content or articles. I found an article that I think I'm going to read tomorrow and talk about on the program. I just don't want to do the same old thing that Fox is doing, or even Newsmax or OAN. These things are boring to me, and they don't really ever get at the problem. They don't really grapple with the real problems that we're having in society. And to me, if we ever hope to regain our liberty, and what I mean by that is economic liberty. You know, you have no liberty without economic liberty. But in order to do that, you know, we've got to be free, and being free means using honest and free money. So with that, I'm going to end the show. Thanks for coming in, everybody. We'll talk to you later. Peace.